right, I think we're going to go ahead and get started, everyone. This is an hour-long session, so we want to pack in as much as we possibly can. Good afternoon, and welcome again to our 2013 Family Philanthropy Conference. My name is Elizabeth Sullivan. I go by Liz. I'm a managing director here at the Council and oversee what we call our kind of private foundation portfolio, which includes our family philanthropy membership. You are here, of course, for the Advocacy 101 session, Fundamental Strategies to Amplify Your Mission. So we have come from what I think was a very thought-provocative opening kickoff to our conference, and there are plenty of tie-ins here that I was sort of fervently trying to weave into our notes at the last minute, but I think that the sort of the tie-ins and the role of systems thinking as a way to address complex problems. We heard that loud and clear from David Peter Stroh's presentation. And then, of course, as this title suggests, this session is kind of a primer on how private foundations can use advocacy as a tool to enhance your philanthropic strategy and mission. And I think that you all should know as well by now that this is one of a handful of sessions here at the conference on philanthropy's role engaging in the policy sphere. I'm sure you're aware that at the Council we have a particular focus on public policy, and our efforts really are about bringing the foundation voice to relevant national policy conversations by educating and working with the Congress, with the White House, executive branches and agencies in Washington, D.C., so pretty much at the federal level. And taken together with our members and our partners, our aim is to promote philanthropy's role and impact in society by telling the story of how philanthropic innovation tackles society's most pressing problems and strategically invests in long-term solutions to those to the challenges and issues. So again, it's about the collaboration with you, our members, our colleagues and partners in the field, to sort of tell the overarching story about our collective impact. So at the conference here, we encourage you to attend sessions on this topic. There is a Washington update on sort of what's going on within the Beltway. There is, a session on how policy affects systems. Clearly, there's going to be a plenary tomorrow morning. You heard from Vicky on the tax reform issue and what's at stake. And immediately following this session, I think at 4:30, is one called Riding the Wave of Civic Engagement, which is with featuring Beth Cantor and some other pretty cool people. So there's kind of a mini track of policy-related sessions that this is really the grounding for that. And so the intention here is to focus on the fundamentals for this hour so that you can use this as a springboard to engage in the discussions that will be subsequently offered throughout the conference. So very quickly, just a quick show of hands for you here in the room. How many of you are with foundations or working with foundations that are currently engaging in public policy or advocacy? So you've activated, you're sort of in the process of, and you're doing some of the work. Show of hands. Great. So presumably the rest are considering moving into this space in the short to long term. That's good. So I think you're all definitely in the right place. And so as such, you know, this is sort of a progressive learning experience throughout the conference. Our goals are really twofold. One, to dispel some of the myths about what private foundations can't and can't do within this advocacy sphere. And, you know, a la the plenary we just came from, can we tackle some of those mental models about some assumptions about what we can and can't do? And also reinforce, in particular, what is possible. And the second objective is to address some of the common barriers to adopting public policy as part of your foundation strategy. Definitely here at the Council, we inquire often from our members about what keeps them from engaging in this work. So we have a few thoughts that we have interwoven in the presentations that you'll hear as well. So we definitely want to tackle some of those head on. But we would love for this to be as much of a conversation as possible. So if there are things that are on your mind that we're not addressing here, please raise them, and we can take it from there. So let me introduce our speakers here. We have a dynamic duo to get to these issues. And first is Kelly Shipp Simone, who is the council's vice president for legal affairs. So she is our general counsel. And prior to joining the council in 2003, I'm not sure if you all are aware that Kelly was served as a law fellow with the Alliance for Justice, one of our colleague organizations in the space. And she's the author of several articles and publications from the council, but the one that pertains to our topic today is Top 10 Ways Private Foundations Can Influence Public Policy. She literally wrote the piece, and I believe that they've been distributed to you there, so that is a takeaway for you, written by yours truly over here. We have extra copies? Oh, great, yes, we have plenty available. Thanks, Shelton. So our second speaker here is Megan Bell, the executive director for the Marie C. and Joseph C. Wilson Foundation in Rochester, New York. Megan's background, her bio, all the bios are on the website, obviously, but her background is primarily in the fundraising field in Chicago. But she's also the vice president of the Richard T. Bell Foundation, her own family's philanthropy, and is a board member of the Grantmakers Forum of New York. So very involved, and not only, you know, wearing the hat of a staff of a family foundation, she herself is involved in the work, so she understands the issues quite intimately in her own right. And just to make the connection, obviously, Megan is the executive director of our conference chair, Nellie Garten, who you heard from at the opening plenary. So we're delighted to have Megan here to further illuminate their family's experience in using advocacy as a way to advance their own systems thinking work around the issues of homelessness. So we're kind of continuing the conversation from the lunch. So with that, let me first invite Megan to share a couple of words, sort of a thumbnail sketch, just to get us acquainted with the foundation at the basic level, and then we can dive a little deeper into your advocacy-specific issues.
Oh, sure. And again, I welcome questions along the way. I really hope this can be a dialogue. But I think you're supposed to talk into the mic so it's recorded.
Yes, please.
Just to be awkwardly formal about it. The foundation, as you said, was founded in Rochester, New York 50 years ago by Joe Wilson and his wife, Peggy. And Joe, just out of context, started Xerox Corporation. So that's where they got their wealth. The foundation has 20 board members, all family, all over the country, literally. And we have some great assets. Nellie is, you know, a wonderful asset, but there are many other great board members that lend expertise in different fields. We are not a large foundation. Our endowment is about $20 million. So you know that you can do this work if you're not a huge foundation. We are really excited to celebrate our 50th anniversary this year. And just so you know, the work that I'm going to talk about spans the last 20 plus years. I've been with the foundation for 2 to 2.5 years. So I'll do my best to represent history.
Great. Thank you so much. So with that, I think we'll start with Kelly outlining some of the kind of rules and regs around advocacy and public policy. And again, this is really addressing the primary challenge that we hear is, you know, private foundations just don't really know what is possible and keep some of this work potentially at an arm's distance because of that sort of myth.
Yeah, and it's also often the lawyers who are telling the foundations this. So that's something we talk, and we get a lot of questions about this work because often as grant-making progresses and other things progress, organizations want to get more involved in the policy, and then they hit this wall. They're told, no, you can't get involved in public policy. And so my job when I talk about this, and I love talking about this topic, is to talk about the rules so you know what's possible. Not so you're worried about what's not possible, but you begin to kind of open your mind about all the possibilities within the law. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. One of the hardest things when I talk about this topic is, what is advocacy? We throw this term around, advocacy. We throw the term public policy around. So I have just a really really basic definition. And then we're going to refine it in the way the IRS defines it. So when I talk about advocacy broadly, I'm talking about a broad range of activities that can include lobbying. It can include civic engagement work, so getting out there and encouraging civic participation. So that type of work, and it can involve all sorts of other things. Advocacy could involve influencing corporations to change their behaviors. It could be a variety of things. But we're going to today really drill down and talk about the rules that sometimes are confusing to people if they're just stepping into this. And that is, what are the tax law rules? What are the rules that apply to you because you are, in fact, a private foundation? And as we get into that, I think it's important to have a basic understanding that the rules in this space are actually different for private foundations and public charities. And we'll talk at the end, when I finish up, I'll talk about granting to public charities who may be involved in advocacy and lobbying specifically. And so I look at the rules as being different as a way to actually also leverage some of your resources if you're working with partners in the public charity space. Private foundations aren't allowed to engage in what's lobbying. But that definition of lobbying is what I'll spend a lot of my time talking about. It's much narrower than you think. It's very easy to think that lobbying is anytime you talk to someone on Capitol Hill or your state legislator or your county council, whatever level you're working at. But the way the IRS looks at this, it's much more narrow. And by being much more narrow, it gives you guys a lot more opportunities. Public charities are allowed to engage in more lobbying. They can actually engage in things that the IRS defines as lobbying, so long as it's an insubstantial amount of their activities. And I'll tell you, same with lobbying, what's an insubstantial amount is often much broader than even the public charities think themselves. We're not going to go into those tests, but know that your public charities actually have a broader ability to engage in this activity. Both private foundations and public charities can engage in nonpartisan political activity. And I want to mention that we're not going to go in depth on that topic today, but things like get out the vote work, public education about candidates, as long as it's done in a nonpartisan way, is space that private foundations and public charities can engage in. So if that's something of interest to you, keep it in the back of your head, and you're welcome to contact us as time goes along if that becomes an area of interest. So I said, we're focusing on how the IRS defines lobbying. There are many definitions of lobbying, and this is always my caveat. If you're engaging particularly at the state or local level, you need to check out what the state and local authorities define as lobbying for registration requirements. They won't restrict your ability to engage in that activity. That's what federal tax law looks at. But what they say is what will trigger you reporting as, quote unquote, a lobbyist. I had that question this week because the law is not matched up in the area. But what we're talking about is what you can and can't do as a private foundation. So when we look at the law that the IRS, and this is an IRS focus, what we look at is two definitions of lobbying, and that's what we're going to walk through. We look at direct lobbying, and that's advocacy where you're directly talking to legislators. And we'll define that in a minute. But legislators, you're having those direct conversations with them or their staff. And then grassroots is where you're out talking to the public in general. You're going to go and put on your website a statement about a particular issue. So those are kind of what we consider grassroots. So I just want to kind of have the framework in your head as we start to drill down. And so let's go through that. And let me tell you, please ask questions as we go along. And if you don't go to the mic, that's okay, because I'll just repeat it.
Kelly, so. I can actually ask a quick question first. So are those labels designated by the IRS?
Yes.
Grassroots lobbying.
Yeah, and that's also the reason we break them down that way, is that's how the IRS defines it. So when we look at direct lobbying, the IRS defines it as a direct lobbying. But when it comes to the rule, they treat it all as lobbying. So that's a great question. So direct lobbying under the IRS rules is a communication. So think about all those ways to communicate. It's a phone call. It's an email. It may even be an actual letter. It could be a fax. Whatever way you're using to communicate, those in-person meetings are becoming more and more important. So the idea is it's a communication, and then it's with a legislator. So when you think about legislators, you think about a variety of people. They're at federal level, you're members of Congress, your senators, your representatives. your state level officials. So those who are in the legislative body in your particular state, you have a city council, your county council, those are also going to be, they're the people who are making law at whatever that particular level you're working at. And their staff, of course. Sometimes when you go to meet with them, you meet with their staff, and that's just in the rules like you're meeting with them. Yeah.
So in other words, the Foundations on the Hill is considered lobbying?
No, we'll actually go through that exact example and why it's not. So no freaking out. No, I'll explain exactly why.
I thought it was a
Yeah, and we'll talk, and I'll give you a preview of that. So we're going to walk through the definition of lobbying, so you can kind of check off in your mind if you're lobbying, and then we'll walk through the exceptions. And your engagement in Foundation on the Hill clearly fits in with an exception.
We wouldn't let you do anything that you couldn't
yeah,
do.
Yeah, no, we're very careful not to inspire. No, we don't inspire our members to violate the law, be assured. So you've got your legislators. So there's typical people you think of. Very occasionally, I put this up there for completeness, but very occasionally you'll be talking to executive officials. And if you're talking to them about the formulation of legislation, then they are going to be considered a quote-unquote legislator. So really, you know, you're talking to the head of your state Department of Education about bill texts they're working on to get into the legislature. So it really is talking to a high-level official who's really working on work that's going to directly go to the legislator. So that's a very narrow exception. The public, if it's a ballot measure, how many of you live in states where ballot measures are a big deal? I know we're standing in a state right now where that is, initiatives, and so a lot of you. And that's where a lot of work is getting done these days. And so if you're talking to the public votes yes or no on that particular legislation in the state. So they're legislators. They're making law. The public's making law in those cases. So if you're talking to the public and it's about a ballot initiative, I'm thinking about whether or not it's direct lobbying. But then there's this big exception. I know some of you work in the area of education. A big exception there, if you're working in the area of education, is members of a school board aren't considered legislators. And so think about that from your perspective with your private foundation hat on and say, we really care about education, we really care. Say it's about teacher evaluation. I know, at least in my area, that's a big issue. So you want to go in front of the school board and talk about teacher evaluation and how you think it could be improved, how it could be done, how they're doing it wrong or right, whatever you want to say. You're talking, so you're communicating, but there's no legislator involved because it's a member of your school board. And so hopefully that's a first example of many areas where you can get involved in advocacy. It's not lobbying, so it's okay for your private foundation to have those discussions with your school board, for example. And that's just one example. You'll see some others there. And so that's one area. The other aspects, and I'll tell you, I think of this as a checklist. So if you were to call me up and say, Kelly, we're struggling with this, and we don't know if this communication with the school board about teacher evaluation is lobbying, I say, okay, let's walk through it. Are you communicating? Yeah, that's usually a given. Are you communicating with the legislator? And as I just said, you're not. So the analysis ends there. You're not engaged in lobbying. And it's activity that you could do as a private foundation. But say it is. Say, yeah, I'm going to Capitol Hill to talk to my legislator about education. The next question is, are you expressing a view? Most cases, this is an issue you care about and you're going to them, you're going to be expressing a view. There may be some narrow exceptions, but that's generally going to be kind of a given. Then the next question is, are you talking about specific legislation? And that's a term of art in the tax regulations, specific legislation. So what you're looking at there is, that's what it excludes, so we'll talk about that in a minute, but is there a bill number? Say there's a bill, you know, House Bill number 1. You know, that's clearly legislation. It can also be where you have a problem and you pair it with a solution. So it doesn't have to be introduced bill. And actually, in some nice IRS guidance they have, they give this example, and since it's a hot topic right now, I'll use it. They say there's an example of there's gun legislation that's been passed in one area, and this other area is looking at it. So they say, you know, this is a problem. Gun violence is a problem. Look to that legislation in that other state, and we'd like to see the same thing. So that's pairing a problem with a specific solution, so you have legislation even though there's not a bill. But what's not legislation comes into play a lot. regulations. Maybe you're concerned about access to housing, but the access to housing is defined within regulations. You know, maybe HUD puts out regulations and you want to comment on them. You've got a communication. In that case, you don't even have a legislator involved because you're talking to a regulatory body. You're expressing a view, and you don't have legislation involved either. So you can actually, as a private foundation, comment on those regulations, and it's not going to be lobbying. Other things to influence: executive orders, and also there's a law on the books, and they want it enforced. You know, that's another example. Litigation, you know, the lawyers love that. You can participate in litigation. Maybe you're filing what's called a friend of the court brief. That's not going to be considered lobbying because you're not involved in legislation. So that's really when we talk about direct lobbying. Once again, you see, I like the rules because they provide a lot of area outside the rules that we can easily operate in, and private foundations can do it and not get into trouble. And then on the grassroots side, so if you call me up and say, Kelly, we're thinking about this, it's communication, but we want to write a letter to the editor. We're really concerned about issue of the environment, let's say, and we want to write a letter to the editor about this as a private foundation. So we're communicating with the public, that's in the newspaper, it's public, or on the web, wherever it's going to be published. We're going to express a view. We think there needs to be change with regard to pollution in our particular river in our community. It could even be about specific legislation. We think that this bill is a really good thing because it's going to tighten the restrictions on dumping in a particular river. So the last question is there what's called a call to action? And that's really what it's going to hinge on, whether I say, yeah, as a private foundation, you can do it, or no, as a private foundation, you can't. Because already you have a communication with the public, you've expressed a view about specific legislation. But have you called people to act? And the regulations define four ways to call people to act. You say at the end of that, before your executive director's signature, you say, contact your legislator today. You have called someone to action, and so that's lobbying. So I would say, as a private foundation, you can't do that. If you provide address, telephone number, other contact information is another example. You provide a mechanism to enable communication. Say you want to put up a take action center on your website. We don't see private foundations doing that, but you'll see it everywhere else. Take action center. That would be a mechanism to help someone contact. Or identifying legislators, saying, you know, Joe, Bob, and Sue will be voting on this. You know, that's an example of calling people to action under these regulations. So if you include any of those things, you can't engage in it because it's lobbying. But if you write that letter and leave those four things off, you can actually, as a private foundation, do that. There is one caution. If you're paying for mass media space, there's a special rule that might bring it back into it in certain circumstances, but it has to be paid mass media for that rule to apply. And just kind of put that rule in the back of your head and say, she said something about paid mass media, let me pick up the phone. Yeah.
So under direct and grassroots,
yes.
You need to have each of these elements.
Absolutely.
To be a necessary condition.
Yep.
To the lobby.
Yeah, so the question for the record.
You can have three out of the direct, but you need to have four.
Right. So the question is whether or not you need all those elements to be lobbying under direct or grassroots. And the answer is yes. So you leave one of those elements out, and you don't have lobbying. And, of course, if you don't have lobbying, then it's something that you all as a private foundation can engage in.
And we'll get these slides. So they'll be available.
We can make them available. The information, all that I'm going over, is also available in that book.
Oh, okay.
And there's actually a flow chart to help you, a quick flow chart to help you kind of walk through it. But let me talk about, as I said, we're going to go high-level overview, quick overview, but let me talk about some of these exceptions, because this is really where we see a lot of private foundations working and really influencing public policy. So say you've walked through those things and you say, yeah, you know, what we just did looks like lobbying. We're going to Capitol Hill and talking to our legislators about preserving the charitable deduction. Kelly, that's lobbying. Why is the council telling me to do that? And we'll explain why that falls into the third bullet there, and you can do it. So these are kind of exceptions on top of everything else I've already talked about you can do. So the first one is what's called a nonpartisan analysis of research. How many of you have ever funded or directly carried out some research activity? So some of you, have any of you ever done it on the public policy side? So a couple of you. So this is something we see more and more of, and that is you all as a private foundation either fund a grantee or directly fund someone to carry out research on a policy issue. Maybe it's access to preschool for children in your community. And maybe it even comes to conclusions about maybe a legislative solution on what would work in your community. If you follow these rules for the nonpartisan analysis study or research, that's something you can fund. But what it requires is you have to have a full and fair discussion of the facts. So I should be able to pick that up knowing nothing about the issue and coming to my own conclusion because it's been presented in a balanced enough way that I can take that information and make my own conclusion. It may agree with yours or not, but there's enough information there. So it says it can advocate a position on an issue at the end, and it may discuss legislative issues. What it can't do is directly call a group to action. So it can't say, contact your legislators today. It can't say, list contact information for legislators. So it can't do three of those four things I list. And so you can't directly say, get involved today, essentially. And then you've got to distribute it in a way. It's not distribution just one side of the issue. And so, in fact, you know, put it on your website. Share it with your grantees who are working in the area. The idea is it's available to enough people, and it could be free or paid. There's a lot of flexibility. But it's not just available to the people who agree with you. Distribute it to all members of Congress. Whatever that is, you're distributing it, and it's available to a wide range of people. So that's one area. The second area is providing technical advice. So this is when you have developed, well, I'll stick with early childhood education, your foundation has developed significant expertise in the area of early childhood education, enough that the legislative body comes to you and says, you know, we'd like to hear your opinion on this issue. We'd like you to submit written testimony as a private foundation. We'd like you to have someone appear at a hearing and talk about this. If it's pursuant to a written invitation, and that can include email, but get it in writing. If it's pursuant to a written invitation and it's from a legislative body, it's not just from one particular, say, senator who really believes in your work. It's from a committee. It's from the full body. You can actually go and submit written testimony or testify and express opinions on a particular issue. And that's because it's pursuant to this exception. And it kind of makes sense because the idea is legislatures should have access to good information and good thinking on issues. So if they're coming to seek you out, then, in fact, you can use this exception and express opinions to a legislative body on issues that you care about. So now getting to the exception that would allow you to participate in foundations on the Hill or issues that are near and dear to the council's heart. Is self-defense communications. And this means you all are private foundations, and sometimes you need to talk to the legislative body, no matter what your position is, about rules about private foundations, about deductibility of contributions to you. Obviously, that's in the big news, one in the news. About things like IRA charitable rollover, if you think, you know, some giving vehicles like that should apply to private foundations. Like private foundation excise tax, whether it should be reduced from 2% to something lower and simplified. Those issues that really are affecting you because you are a C3 private foundation, that's when the self-defense comes into play. And so it's you can go to Capitol Hill and express, you know, or your state legislatures. I know a lot of them are dealing with issues of property tax exemption, a variety of tax issues. You can express views directly to the legislators and their staff about these issues. You can say, that's a great idea. That's a terrible idea, and here's why. And that's because you have this exception built into the regulations that allow you to have these communications. Note that it doesn't apply to grassroots. So you can't talk about these issues, put them on your website and call people to action on these issues. This is really talking about having your expertise and your experiences shared with those who are making the decisions in the legislatures. Are there questions? There's one example on private excise. We have an action center, and this is just a page grab from that that looks at, you know, you could actually respond to this and send a note to your legislators about the, I think, private excise tax, private foundation excise tax. The one other I'll talk about before I wrap up is jointly funded projects. And this is one that's only available to private foundations. And this is if, say, you're funding a project and the government's funding it. We often see this at state levels and localities. You all are both interested in access to housing, and you want to talk to the legislatures about this. This exception, because you're both putting money into a project, you can do things like say, we're not going to fund this project. We're interested in funding it. We're not going to fund it unless you fund it. So you're leveraging your money. You can communicate with them about a joint project. So the idea is because you're kind of joint funders, co-funders in that together, it opens up a little bit more room for you to talk to them about those issues. So yes?
That was actually something I was going to ask related to before you put the money in, sometimes the discussion has to happen first. So do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Might you go and propose this?
Right. So, I mean, I think you have to have a clear intent to put money in and say, you know, we would like to put money in, but this has to happen
right.
first.
Right.
Yeah, that's what this allows is those types of conversations. So the question was, you know, do you have to put the money in first? And if it's really about leveraging the money, then you can have those conversations. Another question. Yeah, so the question is, what are the rules if you are working with a donor-advised fund? And I will tell you, donor-advised funds are typically housed by public charities, so you are actually subject to the rules of public charities, so you actually have a little more flexibility. Obviously, it's going to be up to the what we call the sponsoring organization, the public charity that kind of runs that donor-advised fund, to make decisions about what they'll allow and not allow out of a donor advised fund, but you do have a little more flexibility with the support of that public charity. So there, because it's under a public charity structure, it's different than a private foundation structure. And I'd be happy to talk a little more offline about kind of advocacy from a donor advised fund. Yes?
What happens if you're part of a community conversation where in coming together, some leadership has decided we need to make some changes about regulation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's going to get to what's the issue involved. Like, would it fit, say you were doing it separately, would it fit within one of these exceptions? And it may be, and can become a tricky question when we're working at coalitions, and it's certainly something where there may be a time where you say, you know what, we've got to step back because we're a private foundation, our rules are a little different. You all go do what you need to do, but we can't sign on to that letter. It crosses a line for us. And it will depend on the content. If it's, you know, about the charitable deduction, you may be perfectly fine. But if it's about, you know, access to housing in your community, the answer may be very different. So, yes, one more.
What about appointments? Can private foundations weigh in on appointments for federal or state offices?
That's a great question. And the question is what about appointments to federal and state offices? And if they have to be voted on by the legislature, that's where you're going to have the problem, because it does fall within the lobbying. And the IRS has been clear about things like judicial appointments, because Congress is voting on them, then they fall within lobbying. And for public charities, I will tell you that's good news, because they're not about partisan political activity. It's about lobbying activity, which gives them a little more flexibility. But that's a great question. There are great questions if you're in the international sphere about, you know, what is the United Nations? Is that a legislative body? And I'd be happy to talk with people offline about that. There's gray area here, too. I'll be perfectly frank. Let me go through a couple other things, and then I'll come back to questions at the end.
Okay.
Grants for advocacy. This is, you kind of, as your role in a funder, you may want to fund grantees who do get engaged. They're working on policy issues that you care about, and you want to fund them. And what the IRS says about this is actually relatively flexible when you think about it. What you can't do is you can't earmark a grant for lobbying, and that term earmarked is used a lot in the tax code, and what it means is you can't give them an agreement, and there's a wink, wink, nod, nod agreement there, they're going to explicitly use this money for lobbying. But if you don't earmark it, so you give it to them, there's a couple ways you can give grantees who are public charities grants, and they may be able to use your money for lobbying. So the first one is a general support grant. You fund a grantee that may be doing a variety of things, a food bank that may be working on anti-hunger, but they're also distributing food and doing other activities in the community. You give them a general support grant, they can use it for whatever they choose. And they may use your money to lobby. Now, the key for making that work, if you want to give them maximum flexibility, is don't put in your grant agreement that they can't use the money for lobbying. Because if you do that, then they have to follow the rules you put in their grant agreement. You're not required by law to put language in a grant agreement to a public charity that they can't use your money for lobbying. And that's something, you know, if you're entering this space, go back and read your grant agreement and see what it says, because I'll blame it on the lawyers again. Lawyers like that language and they want to put it in. And there's some great samples. There's some samples on our website, on a toolkit. We work with some other groups that talk about that. There's other samples out there. Talk about how you can write language around lobbying that doesn't prohibit your grantees' flexibility. I do have the one caveat down there. If it is a grant that requires expenditure responsibility, so you have to do that heightened due diligence because the grant is a certain type of supporting organization, I can talk to you offline about those rules. But if you have a grant that requires heightened due diligence under the tax rules, you can't use these because there's different rules that apply. But for most of your public, almost all of your public charity grantees, you don't have to restrict their money for lobbying. One more, and grants to public charities, and then I'm going to hand it over to Megan, is you can also give project grants. So say you want to give a grantee $15,000 to engage in their activity. I'll go stick with my food bank example. You want to give them $15,000 towards their anti-hunger program. So their anti-hunger program includes distributing food, and it includes some lobbying. And they've given you a project budget. So this is where your grantees have to understand the rules a bit. They're going to give you a project budget, and they're going to explain out of this $30,000 project that $20,000 is distribution of food, public education about the issue, all these things, and then $10,000 of this project is lobbying. So you have this budget now that says, okay, $30,000 budget, $20,000 is this great public education, other activities, $10,000 is lobbying. You as a private foundation can fund up to $20,000 of the grant because that project, $20,000, is non-lobbying activity. Now, my magic trick of the day is, of course, you don't have to restrict that money and say you can't use our money for lobbying. So then they go to this other private foundation and say, we'd like a grant for $10,000 from you. We have this great project. Here's our project budget. $30,000 project, $20,000 is non-lobbying, $10,000 is lobbying, fully disclosed, no reason to lie. Will you give us a $10,000 grant? And they say, great, we're following the project grant rules. You haven't restricted our money. We've now fully funded a $30,000 project that involves some lobbying, all with private foundation dollars, and nobody is going to get into trouble because everybody followed the rules when they followed the process. And there's been an information letter that confirms this. I will say so that's kind of what we call the project grant rules. Sometimes you'll hear them referred to the old school way as the Macintosh rules, so there are rules out there. I have a couple questions, and then I'm going to turn it over. Yeah. Yeah.
And the other funder is requiring that same thing.
Yep. The fact that it's
how does that work?
They can actually report to you that they use your money for lobbying, unless you've restricted it. So that's not going to make it a grant that you earmarked for lobbying or against the rules. They're telling you what they did with their money, with the money you gave them, and you followed the rules when you made it, and that's okay if they report what the outcomes were from that project. And so it feels weird. I can see it in many people's faces. It feels uncomfortable. But it's okay. It's about following the rules and giving them the flexibility to make the decisions about how they use that money. Let me take you because I missed you before, and then we'll go here, and then I'm going to wrap up.
I'm wondering what we're capable of doing as individuals who are also members of the board.
That's a great question. What can we do as individuals? And if you're wearing your individual hat, you don't lose your First Amendment rights, you can do this on your own time. The key is if there's any confusion, you need to dispel that. So,
I mean, so in my community,
mm-hmm.
Found foundation I'm on has funded programs for the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And as an individual, I have advocated
right.
for, you know.
Yeah, so it's if you're going to the legislator to legislature to talk about it, you should say, I'm here in, if there's confusion, you should say, I'm really here in my personal capacity. They may know that in with your other hat on, you may be part of the family, the foundation, but you really have to be clear that you're doing it in your personal capacity.
So almost all of this stuff can be, I don't know, I feel like you can almost just set it aside if you go as an individual.
Yeah, I mean, as an individual, you have the right to go and advocate with your personal hat on, but you can't be using foundation funds to do it. If you're staff, you can't be using foundation time to do it. So that's really the key. And one other question over here.
Yeah, it's really just a clarification.
Yeah, please.
That you can basically give money that you know may be used for lobbying, as long as you're not specifying it be used for lobbying or excluding that it be used for lobbying.
Right, or telling them to use it to lobby.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can't specify or deny it,
right.
But you may understand that it...
That they're engaged in that activity. And that, I think, is why there's these special rules that say your grantee can be involved in advocacy, and that's okay, and you can fund them. And here are the two ways how. I mean, I think you want to look at the ways how and make sure you're following those rules. I will say, I know there's probably more questions, but I want you to hear from Megan, who's engaged in this activity. Here's some resources here. Obviously, our website has resources. There's a great website, and unfortunately, the person from the Moore Foundation just left, but they're participating in a session at 4:30. Gates Foundation, Packard Foundation, Hewlett, and Moore have put together an amazing project. They call it Maya Project because this animation, I don't know what you call them.
Avatar, maybe?
Avatar walks you through the rules of this in a really great way. So if you're working with other people in your foundation who want to learn about it, Maya will work you through it, and it's free. They've done it and it really is a gift to the field. They actually also have a second module now on expenditure responsibility, which I briefly mentioned. But I really, I recommend that resource out there. And also Alliance for Justice, who's here on site, has a website that talks about a lot of these rules, talks about evaluation of advocacy. So another resource you can look to. So with that, I'm going to turn it over.
Thanks, Kelly. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Great.
They never give enough room for computers and notes. Well, I want to thank you for being here and for wanting to learn about doing this kind of work. I think it really plays off what our plenary was this afternoon. And I was sitting with board members from our family, and we're going, "Ooh, we sort of do this," but nobody thought about it when we started out. So I just want to make that clear. It's been an evolution, and it's still evolving our process in policy and advocacy. So the foundation funds mostly homeless work, and that is because Joe Wilson had a philosophy that everyone deserves a home or a place to live in order to improve their lives. And if you don't have a stable place to live, how can you achieve the other goals in life? So in the late 80s, a board member visited a transitional housing facility. And at the time, that was sort of new. There weren't a lot of those around. And brought that back to the board and said, let's build one in Rochester. And they said, fantastic, what a cool idea. We have never done anything but reactionary grant making. So with a $9 million endowment, they built a $7 million transitional housing facility. They didn't fund it all. They funded about $1 million, and the other money was raised through public-private partnerships. And that facility still opens, or still functions today as its own separate organization. It is not affiliated with the foundation. So they thought Wilson Commencement Park was amazing. And they were so proud of the work they had done. And they loved that they were doing something forward-thinking. So they went through a strategic planning process. And about a year of strategic planning, they decided they were going to really work on housing and family homelessness specifically. So they thought, we should replicate Wilson Commencement Park. It was so good. Because the board is all over the country, they wanted to bring Wilson Commencement Park to their communities. The problem that they saw, though, was Wilson Commencement Park the best possible choice, which was fantastic that they asked those questions. They didn't just leap into it. They wanted to know more. So they did an alumni study to gauge the success of Wilson Commencement Park for the residents there. And this was part of what became our 10-year work in studying family homelessness. So they hired the National Center on Family Homelessness, otherwise known as NCFH, and they really took the lead on researching the residents of Wilson Commencement Park. This, then they created a replication guide from that with the help of a couple other organizations around the country, a couple other facilities. But they still weren't satisfied. How did they know that this was the best model? Because there are other housing models. If you're not familiar with homelessness, there's emergency shelters, as we heard about this morning and or this afternoon, and there are permanent supportive housing. So permanent supportive housing is, as the name suggests, for long-term care for people who really have a hard time becoming self-sufficient, people who have disabilities of some kind. And whereas transitional housing is really meant for people to live in for 6 months to 2 years, and it helps them stabilize and get on their feet. Ideally, the goal is that once they complete their program at their facility, then they will be able to have stable housing on their own because they've gotten supports to learn financial responsibility, job training, other social services. So asking the question, how do we know that transitional housing is the best? They initiated a longitudinal study called SHIFT. And this really looked at the three different housing models across New York State and four different cities in the state. And they took baseline interviews, 30-month and 60-month interviews with residents. They signed the contract in 2005, and we are expecting completion this winter. So I just want you to know that it's a long process. They signed the contract in 2005. They agreed to work with NCFH in 2003, so it took time to even sign the contract. It took 2 years for them to finally start the research project. We had great board members, Nellie one of them, who really took the task of working with NCFH to design the study. So there was hands-on work from board members to do this. I don't want you to think that NCFH gave them money and NCFH just did everything. That would be unrealistic. But the board buy-in was fantastic. They agreed. They thought this was a great way to learn more about the area. However, the board got bored. It's a research study. And those of you who have engaged in those, it is so hard to be enthusiastic when all you're doing is saying, yes, we completed 15-month interviews. Yes, we inputted data from 15-month interviews. It's boring. So just be aware of that. It has also taken longer than we thought. It was supposed to be completed last year, and it is still not done. There are bumps along the road. The total budget for our SHIFT study, and this includes the replication and the alumni study, was $1.6 million, and we're the sole funder of this project. What we will do, what we'll use the study for beyond policy and advocacy work, is also to reevaluate our own giving. Now that once the study is complete, we will say, should we replicate Wilson Commencement Park? That question we asked ourselves 10 years ago, is that still relevant? So it will really help us define our strategy in terms of giving. Now, some things, opportunities arose during this entire process. Because of our great relationship with NCFH, they felt that they could come to us with new projects, and that was a real blessing. So the first is in 2008. They started doing state-by-state data on homeless children, and they wanted to produce this report card on America's youngest outcasts. This was a huge opportunity for the foundation to actually have something tangible that they could produce that was based on data. And while they were so bored with the research study, I think they made a decision in a month. And if you have a 20-person board, I think you can appreciate that that is phenomenal. So this had some huge presence. And the day it was released, it had 800 newspaper articles printed in one day alone across the country. And President Obama mentioned it in a national address. So it, for the board engagement, it was really fantastic for them to see that their money was really being leveraged. And the cost for this project was $150,000. In 2011, they updated it, which we didn't have to fund. That was part of our original grant. So this is still getting traction, and it is still working in the states. Now, because of this, NCFH really saw an opportunity. There were the data really suggested to states to start campaigns of their own to end family homelessness. So there are states, Florida, I know, is one, Mississippi, I think Arizona, they have their own campaigns, and that's through NCFH. But NCFH really saw opportunity to go to a national level and to affect federal policy. So they came back to us and in 2010 and said they wanted to do a campaign to end child homelessness. And the board said, okay, this is totally different. We've never really looked into this. But it just seemed like a no-brainer to them. They really looked at the linkages of the data in the states and came up with a 3-year funding model. And it was about $500,000. We're just finishing our third year this summer. The goals for the federal policy is a little bit different than just our goals. So our personal goals were really twofold. First was to engage national stakeholders and to affect public policy, obviously. Another big goal was to raise the profile of NCFH. Here we are, this partner, and we're about to come out with this huge research study, and we wanted our partner to have a voice and have a presence in the national community on family homelessness. So we saw this as a real way to leverage their capacity and their voice. So part of the grant is to hire a policy director, and she works directly in DC, and she convenes stakeholders. She speaks with federal agencies. She speaks with members of Congress and Senate, but she doesn't lobby, just so you know that. And it's to really convene the needs of kids who are homeless. And it is so diverse that, you know, part of one of the goals she's working on is the Violence Against Women Act, because if women are battered and they flee their homes with their children, they need security. And that's an issue. It's family homelessness. So things like that. She works with the Boys and Girls Club. She works with so many organizations on a goal. So we are currently engaging in that. And then the campaign said, hey, a photographer who spent years photographing homeless families gifted his entire collection of photography to NCFH. So they asked us if they could repurpose $10,000 of our grant to have a traveling exhibit. And this was, to us, perfect. It tells the story of family homelessness. And here we are mired in data and policy work. And this is a way to say, here are homeless families. This is what they look like. It was a profound way to get our message out, and we saw it as a real link between all the other work that we were doing. And you can see some of these, part of this exhibit, in the exhibitor room. And they are really touching, but the exhibit has traveled across the country. It has been in HUD, but its main goal is to reach the public. So it's been in state buildings, university campuses. It's there really to educate the public that this is an issue. So I want to say what came easily. Board buy-in, surprisingly. Our board, even though in the past they had some, you know, issues that every family board has, really saw all of these as opportunities, and they had an open mind to things coming out. They didn't say, 10 years ago, they didn't say, we want to do a federal policy campaign. They started with baby steps, and it has grown. And none of these things were thought of at the beginning. It all came to them along the way. What was a big help was board members' knowledge, like Nellie and some other board members that could really participate on this work. Something else that was beneficial to us is before they embarked on all of this work, they had one pot of money, and that's where grants were distributed from. Once they did their strategic planning, they saw that there would be a board disconnect from all of this research. It's so academic, so they wanted other opportunities for the board to feel engaged and that they were doing something. So they split it into three different pots of money. So we have the board money, which goes to the policy. They have discretionary grant money, so they can use for whatever they want in their communities. And then we have a committee that awards grants in Rochester specifically, and those grants can be anything. It doesn't have to be towards homelessness or anything like that. And that's worked really well. It's been very successful in keeping the board feeling like they're engaged. Some challenges. Time. It has taken a long time to do the research study. It's also time on the public policy work. You don't just set a public policy goal and you snap your fingers and it happens. You have to expect that with elections, things change. You have to be aware of those things. So time is a big one. Engagement and communication, as I've mentioned, we could have done a better job communicating to the board successes along the way for the study or just keeping them informed of what's going on in general. I think a lot of times you think, well, it's boring, but they still need to know. And there weren't enough benchmarks in SHIFT, which are harder to come up with in a research study. Your benchmarks are that you did your study, that you've made your interview goals or things like that. But the campaign has provided a better route for benchmarking, and they're much more enthusiastic when they hear reports about that because they see real work happening, or not real work, they see work happening. So for the future, we're going to continue working on this campaign. Even though our funding structure ends in June, the NCFH is committed to keeping their policy director and to continue working on the campaign. So we feel very good about that our grant, when it ends, doesn't end their work. They see it as a real necessity for what they're doing in the long term. And, you know, we may continue to fund them. We will disseminate our data, and that we're in a process right now to get our study out there to the community and how that can be effective. And then we will reevaluate ourselves as a foundation and see what our goals, where our goals are and where our funding strategy will be. So just to wrap up, we started small. We started local with our alumni study. We grew to a region with the SHIFT study, and then we went to national with the campaign. We didn't start nationally. That would have been very daunting to a foundation our size. And Joe Wilson, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, once people's vision is short-sighted in the short term and not large enough in the long term, which means if you keep focused, you will fulfill your goal. So,
thank you.
Thanks, you're welcome.
So we actually have copies of the foundation's federal policy agenda, physical hard copies. So as you consider questions to ask in our final minutes here of either Megan or Kelly, let me just pop off the stage here and distribute those. And also just wanted to remind as well that we have, I'll be circulating an evaluation to the session. But we are just at the top of the hour, and if you have a few more minutes, I think our speakers can stick around for
Absolutely.
A few. We don't have to be anywhere until 4:30, so we can continue on with some questions as well. So let me just go ahead and do that. Additional thoughts or questions for our speakers? Aaron.
Aaron Dorfman with the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy. Just want to offer that in addition to understanding the legal barriers, I often find that foundations sometimes think it's a little fuzzy on why they should fund advocacy work, and we've done some research that might be helpful if that's the case in your foundation, showing a return on investment of 115 to 1 for investments by foundations in advocacy and community organizing and civic engagement work. Right. So.
And also some great examples of other foundations doing it. And that's what we get asked a lot, are what are examples of other people doing this, and how are they doing it, and what are the results?
So exactly. There are a lot
great resources out there.
There are, obviously what we're doing is academic, and it's very high level, but there are more engaging, simpler ways to work in this field if a 10-year research study isn't your goal.
Yes.
Did you consider other organizations to do the research besides the Council on Homelessness, whatever it's called?
Yes, we did.
How did you decide?
We could have. They did an RFP process, and they spent about a year going through organizations. I think they sent the RFP to 17 different research bodies, and I want to say six responded, and they narrowed it down to three, and had all day interviews with those, and then brought that to the board. So it wasn't the whole board interviewing these candidates. It was a small committee. And they really did that work.
Did you have someone on your board who knew how to set up research so you had the right criteria for selection?
Yes, Nellie Garten has a PhD in this area. She didn't have her PhD at the time, but she was working on that. So yes, but other members of the committee had law degrees, so they were fairly familiar with this process. But I don't want to say that they still could have done the work without those members on the board. They were a great asset, but I don't want you to feel like you can't do it because you don't have someone with a PhD in policy research on your board.
Can you just say one more word about the question around kind of measurement and impact? I think one of the barriers that we have heard from our members around, our contributions can be diverted elsewhere to have real direct impact. How do you address that from your perspective?
Well, I think it goes back to what we heard in our opening session today. Our goal isn't to end family homelessness. I mean, that would be fantastic, but you have to set some limitations to your pie in the sky goals. So I think being able to have smaller benchmarks is great, but. Actually, Nellie's mom, Deirdre, will be presenting on evaluation on Tuesday, specifically on evaluating the success of our research study. So I encourage you to go to that session. I mean, you'll hear more about the Wilson Foundation. But it is risky, no doubt. There are a lot of risks that were taken by the foundation to do this, especially with their asset size. And I can't say for sure whether or not everything came out the way we wanted. But to measure our own advocacy, I guess, is a real boon. So to be able to say, to go from we want to replicate this facility to measuring really the field and our capacity to do that is what this study says to me. And evaluating who we are and what we want to do now. And also the field has changed. 1990, transitional housing seemed amazing, but now there's a big policy shift towards rapid rehousing, and maybe we want to be doing that. So, that's where I see our measurements going into.
Additional questions on anything that's been discussed at this point?
I'll say, if you want the slides, just give me your card, and then I can email them to you. I'd be happy to.
Yeah, thank you. Please, for sure. You can bring your business cards up and leave them on the table here in the front, and pick up one of the policy copies of the policy agenda for the Wilson Foundation. So,
yeah, please feel free to reach out to us throughout
Thank you.
Throughout the conference. We'll be here, and I thank you for your participation.
Yes, thank you all. Mm-hmm.